welcome to the 7th episode of the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Welcome back, everybody, or if you're here for the first time, welcome for the first time. I'm happy to introduce those of you who don't yet know her to Dr. Aglaya Zelos. Dr. Zelos works in Athens. She's recently taken a strong interest in acute liver failure in pediatric patients. And in Athens, a few years ago, she coordinated a single-topic conference held by SBGAN that attempted to summarize what we know about what acute liver failure is in children, infants, toddlers, and how we should address it. With that as the lead-in, of course, we're going to be talking about acute liver failure in children today. Aglaya, have you been seeing acute liver failure of the sort that has made all the newspapers recently?
We haven't had a true case in Greece so far.
Nothing like that. I imagine that that is really a T-cell rich hepatitis. And we've recently spoken with Dr. Marianne Samin of King's College London on that topic. And I'd like to know, why in the world do you think that Greece might have been spared this? Why is there a geographical disparity in Europe in the distribution of these children?
Well, T-cell hepatitis inducing acute liver failure could be a different entity. It could be an immune reaction to some sort of infection. It may have to do with exposure to coronavirus, could be of other autoimmune or immune etiology, who knows? But here in Greece, we haven't had a case that resulted in liver failure, at least with an unknown etiology like the ones that were described in Northern Europe and in America, in one state, in one particular state in Alabama. So I really don't know what the reason for that is.
I guess we're still collecting data on a lot of aspects of acute liver failure in children. The position papers that you drew up as a result of that single-topic conference are, for me, as a histopathologist, frankly frightening. There's so much to know. There are so many things that can cause liver failure. And if I were working in a peripheral hospital as a pediatric hepatogastroenterologist, and a child with suspected liver failure came into my ward, I would say, get that child to Athens. That if I lived in Greece, isn't that the most important thing to know about acute liver failure in children?
Exactly. The first thing is to understand that a child is in liver failure, and that is a common mistake. Not really understanding that a child is in trouble, because not only you have to have the biochemical evidence, elevated liver enzymes and cholestasis, meaning elevated direct hyperbilirubinemia, but you have to recognize that a patient has prolonged prothrombin time and not necessarily elevated ammonia levels. And that is a mistake that is often made, and a clinical case of acute liver failure may be overlooked, because in children, especially those with prolonged PT and an INR of greater than 2, we do not need an increased ammonia level to call it acute liver failure. So any child with sky-high transaminases and a prolonged PT should be thought that is not responsive to vitamin K is thought to have acute liver failure. And acute liver failure is really hard to be recognized in smaller children and babies. And these patients need to be recognized early and then transferred to a tertiary center because, as you've seen in the paper, the workup that needs to be done is huge. It needs to be immediate. It involves extensive investigations. You have to be able to exclude metabolic disease. You have to be able to do viral studies, mainly PCR virology, because serology is not very sensitive in picking up viral infections in the setting of acute liver failure.
Uh-huh.
So there are a lot of, you know, sensitive, detailed things that you have to do to get to the diagnosis and actually get to appropriate treatment for these patients.
You have to have the appropriate specialists right there ready to swarm all over that child and to get the studies underway. Well, we'll talk about gestational-associated alloimmune liver disease later, I suppose. But one of the things that I took away from those papers is that it's really not uncommon for a child with acute liver failure to need to go on to liver transplantation, that supportive care doesn't work so well as one might hope. Am I wrong in that?
You're right. And when it comes to small babies, to neonates and young infants, this age group has a very poor outcome. They are very much at risk of death because they have metabolic diseases that sometimes are undiscovered. They can have this GALT process, the gestational alloimmune liver disease, that's pretty catastrophic, and if not recognized, it leads to death in the majority of cases. And so this age group is very sensitive and needs immediate attention. And one very common cause is viral infections, perinatal infections in that age group, such as herpes virus infections. So that is essential to intervene early, even before getting your PCR confirmation with acyclovir in the small babies. This is a category that is very puzzling and creates a lot of distress in the clinical setting when it happens. Neonatal acute liver failure.
Neonatal acute liver failure. I do remember one liver biopsy specimen that I saw at King's in which the liver was necrotic. There were herpes virus inclusions all through the liver biopsy specimen. Completely unsuspected, the mother had never had what she recognized as an acute herpes virus infection. These things can come out of nowhere and bite you. And the number of things that you have to keep in mind and that you have to study and have to be ready to intervene in, again, the best possible reason for moving the child to a tertiary care institution as quickly as possible. Are you running into children in whom these transfers are delayed?
Sometimes, yes, but in our country are very sensitized. Agia Sophia Children's Hospital, where I work, is the referral center for pediatric liver disease in Greece. And we get transfers from the islands, from different parts of Greece, and pediatricians are kind of sensitive in picking up those patients with liver disease. And we do certainly have patients in acute liver failure. We see quite frequently cases, yes.
Frequent instances of liver failure. What's the distribution among your set of cases?
We have cases of all ages. Certainly we have the neonates and the infants less than 1 year of age that they present with either infections or GALT or metabolic liver disease of various etiologies. And then we have the toddlers and older children that present also with metabolic liver disease, autoimmune diseases, mitochondrial diseases. We've had cases recently. And then we have the older children that present with medications, overdosing medications. Common ones is acetaminophen, but it has a good outcome usually. We've never had to do a liver transplant in a patient with acetaminophen toxicity. But the majority of kids are in the school age category.
That interests me. Most kids with acute liver failure are in school age category. Are you taking that up into adolescence for kids with Wilson disease as well?
We've had, for the older children, we've observed that we have Wilson's disease and we have autoimmune hepatitis.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Well, I want to take issue with one aspect of your classification of liver disease, and that is with GALD. I've always wanted to call that not acute liver failure, but acute on chronic liver failure. That there's chronic liver failure in utero in a lot of these kids, and that once there's no longer the placenta, once there's no longer the mother to provide life support, then the baby crashes and burns. And it was interesting to see that it was considered as ALF, pediatric ALF, in your paper. If I'd been on, nobody asked me, of course, but if I'd been there, I'd have said, hey, let's just shift this a little bit. One of the reasons that I'd say that is that so often in these kids, he can't have liver failure. He must be septic or something because the transaminases aren't elevated. Well, gee whiz, there's no more liver cells left to die. Where are you going to get the transaminases from? They're ominously low.
That is correct. And actually, there could be very tricky to recognize those infants that they're engulfed, because only last week we had a case like this where a baby was born with transaminases that were not very elevated, but the baby had cholestasis, had hypoalbuminemia, had prolonged PT, low platelets, and a devastating picture, started bleeding and immediately went into low renal perfusion, and the diagnosis was missed by the neonatologist. And by the time it was transferred to the pediatric, the neonatal ICU at our hospital, I asked what was the ferritin, and it was really high. And then we start thinking about that. We gave the IVIG, which is the therapy for this alloimmune liver disease, and it did help for a little while, but then the child relapsed. So it's really important for those cases to be recognized early so that you can intervene, because there is poor outcome otherwise. But luckily, we have this therapy to offer now, the IV immune globulin, that really has changed the outcome of those infants. Has about 80% improvement in mortality. They live, and unless it's given too late, then it's not helpful.
Then it's not helpful. No. Well, with that in mind, we have the questions of how to support an acute liver failure child. With those patients, you have the option of intravenous immunoglobulin. That doesn't do a thing for viral infection or for mitochondrial disease or for some of the other disorders that present in early infancy with overwhelming hepatocellular insufficiency. I'm just thinking about how difficult it is to sort these kids out timely and then to apply appropriate therapy.
Right. A lot of different things need to happen once you get a patient like that in your hands. First, you have to stabilize the patient. You have to do some initial care measures. Patients need to be in the ICU setting. You need to fluid support them. You need to correct their hypoglycemia. You need to probably give them antibiotics empirically. You don't know what's going on. This is a systemic multi-inflammatory response. So you see all the consequences of inflammation that you have to treat. treat. Most importantly, you have to make sure you don't get brain injury. You have to make sure they, you know, have increased intracranial pressure as a result of hyperammonemia. You have to, at the same time, you have to figure out what's going on. What is your differential diagnosis according to age? And what we highlighted in this paper and that came out of the studies from the PALF study in America was that age-appropriate diagnosis is very important. And since 40% of the cases remain indeterminate, meaning you have no clue what's going on and therefore you have no treatment to offer, you don't know what to give, you have to investigate those cases very thoroughly. 40% unknown causes in cases of liver failure, that's a tremendous percentage of lack of diagnosis. And I think we need to work on that. Could it be a novel virus we're not catching? Could it be something with the immune system? Could it be an incomplete workup? These are the things that need to be addressed at a clinical level, in the clinical setting, when we get a patient like that.
Are there ongoing studies that seek to address these questions? Multi-center studies? So if tell us about those, please.
There have been multi-center studies, and in fact, that is the only way to go because cases are not that many. And unless you collaborate and have registries, there's not going to be able to draw any conclusions from individual observations and case reports. So I believe observations are being continued and long-term follow-up. But in terms of the cases here in Europe, you know, we have to be able to continue with registries and try to get some more data on the prevalence, the diagnoses that are prevalent in Europe, and go on from there.
Is there at the moment any central coordinated registry? I think that's going to be a no, just judging from the gap between my question and your answer.
There are registries for liver transplantation in Europe, and they collect a lot of the data centrally for those. But for acute liver failure, I think there should be an opportunity to do an active registry for that as well in Europe.
That sounds, as you say, like the only way to make progress is to have all of these kids tabulated and to have all of them worked up in a more or less uniform manner so that there aren't the questions of, did we miss something? That was one of the principal categories in unidentified causes of liver failure, is we just didn't look for the right thing, according to what I just heard you say. Is that something that ESPGHAN ought to be central in organizing and coordinating, don't you think?
I agree. And one of the most important things in treating acute liver failure is the timing of liver transplantation. Uh-huh. The decision to proceed with a liver transplant, the criteria that a patient must meet. And unfortunately, in pediatrics, it's really hard to assess the timing because we cannot follow the scores that are used for adults, because children are different. And there have been several scores that have been used, the King's College criteria, the Clichy, and the MELD system regarding the severity of the patient in acute liver failure and then the timing of the liver transplantation. But again, there are limitations because metabolic liver disease is so variant and has different outcomes and different presentations, and you never know when is the right time. And actually, the best time is the individual time for each patient. We do individual care, individual mm-hmm. decisions. You need to be careful about is you know, where to draw the line, and there are certain contraindications for patients in acute liver failure that require liver transplantation if there is systemic disease. But then again, we've stepped on those cases, and even say in mitochondrial disorders, sometimes you may proceed with liver transplantation if the head is not affected, if the brain is working and is in that the child has good neurological function. So we make exceptions on an individual basis, and certainly because we have the living-related living transplantations, if a mother is willing to give in those circumstances, we go ahead and we proceed, and there's a solution for this child.
Well, liver transplantation isn't all or nothing anymore, is it? Not with auxiliary transplantation, with the possibility of providing either a temporary organ that can be discarded after the native liver recovers, or for that matter with hepatocyte transplantation, which I think Céline Philippi and Anil Dhawan at King's are working on in particular. It's easier, right, I think, for surgeons to adopt a new technique and to utilize it than it would be to set up a hepatocyte isolation and alginate encapsulation and all the rest of it at a particular institution. But how many institutions in Europe are actually performing auxiliary transplantation other than King's?
King's is the center that has published, and I really know that they've had more cases than anybody else, I think. It is a brilliant idea. It's a bridge, really, between to recovery. Mm-hmm. You have to be familiar with it. There's got to be the protocols. King's is really the only center that I know that performs this kind of liver transplant in patients. Certainly, hepatocyte mm-hmm. transplantation has a promising future, but everything is experimental at this stage.
Well, that's for sure. But so was bridge transplantation with the auxiliary liver, and at least at King's, now that's part of the therapeutic armamentarium. You must be concerned in monitoring these patients. Are we moving to transplantation perhaps too fast? For example, with the acute liver failure of recurrent type, the ones that have to do with transfer RNA deficiencies, is there any, without the molecular biology workup fully in hand, how can you be sure?
I have to say something about genetics. Genetics has becoming so important in our days. Uh-huh. And in fact, we try to send for genetics as soon as possible. It really helps you, really guides you. If you can get genetics to turn around in just a few weeks, in some centers they can get genetic information within weeks or within a week. And that helps because then it determines prognosis. It really helps you make decisions regarding transplantation. Obviously, you don't want to transplant a patient who may not need a transplantation, but you don't want to proceed with a transplantation for somebody who would not need it or would not make good use of the organ.
That's for sure, too. Looking through all the list of cases of possible etiologies, I felt really abashed as a histopathologist because it seemed to me that liver biopsy was falling way to the back of the line among the tests that might provide useful information. When do you recommend liver biopsy in your patients? That is, again, if they can be biopsied because of hypocoagulability.
See, that's the limitation. Patients have a prolonged PT. They're pretty high risk to do a percutaneous liver biopsy. They could be small babies with bleeding diatheses. It's really the complications that you think of when performing a liver biopsy in this setting. Now, many centers, unfortunately, we don't have it in Greece. You can do the transjugular liver biopsy. You have to have certainly experienced interventional radiologist for this, you may get a lot of information. I strongly believe in liver histology, and it's really, I think you need to get as much information as you need from your patient. However, if in cases of devastating liver injury and necrosis, you tell me whether you're going to be able to help us at all.
Devastating liver injury and necrosis. Well, I could at least tell you, I think, if there had been clinically inapparent liver disease for a long while beforehand. Okay. That would shift from acute on chronic and acute. That might be important to you. I could also, I think, if it was a lovely, big, thick, with plasma cell, lupoid-type autoimmune hepatitis, I could say, hey, go on, give the steroids. and that within a day. And you might not have your viral, you might not have all your viral studies back in time, but I could say, look, on the odds, this is just going to be another autoimmune hepatitis. So maybe I could be useful, maybe.
I think small studies on liver biopsy in the setting of acute liver failure have shown that liver histology is helpful.
Well, now that I know that I haven't wasted my life in liver biopsy interpretation, I can ask you, where do we go from here? We've touched briefly on the need for coordinated central registries and coordinated and defined programs of investigation of patients with acute liver failure. What should these future studies be looking for in order to make a difference in how we diagnose and how we treat?
Well, there are a lot of questions that need to be answered, a lot of challenges to be addressed. For instance, why are younger children more prone to indeterminate PALF? Is there a role for immune and metabolic predispositions? Why are younger livers more resistant to ischemic and vascular injury? Is PALF also characterized by rebalanced hemostasis, like a hypercoagulable state as in adults? Is the hemostatic profile similar in PALF of different etiologies, for instance? Is this activated T-cell hepatitis that you previously mentioned a complication variety of hepatic insults? Does the diagnosis require measures of immune activation, peripheral circulation, and a liver biopsy in the acute setting, as you mentioned? Would immunosuppression interrupt harmful inflammatory cascades or dampen regeneration? I think we need to know more about the biology of inflammation. That requires a lot of further investigation, because in that way you can get into more pathways, you can get more into finding new therapeutics to intervene. And then on the clinical setting, in children, when we come to acute liver failure, we need to improve ourselves in the setting of the ICU. How do we prevent the complications of hyperammonemia, brain injury, brain imaging? When do you do it? Obviously, when the patient is safe to be transferred to the MRI, but then is the MRI a good test to assess for clinical encephalopathy? Where do we go with continuous renal replacement therapy? When do you start it? Obviously, the sooner the better. But what is the outcome in children? I mean, we need more studies, more children, larger samples to draw better conclusions in the management of those patients.
And for that, it seems, at least to me, that we need ESPGAN involvement and coordination and support.
That's true.
Well, if you can put on a single topic conference, you certainly ought to be able to pull together all of those people who contributed to the conference and say, now, let's work on a program to address these questions. Is that underway?
Well, The conference really brought together experts in the field. We also are in the process of trying to write a position paper about the management of acute liver failure and then proceed from that. Acute liver failure is being considered in the hepatology committee as a very serious project to work on. So we will get you more information about that, hopefully soon.
I'm looking forward to it. Folks, I want to tell you a little bit about my own interactions with Aglaia. I think they go back 30 years or so, right?
At least 20.
Well, I didn't want to make her seem older than she is. I apologize. Well, at least 20 then, at least 20. And I think that I've been fascinated by this woman ever since I found out that she lives and she practices in Greece, and she has the perfect American accent of my homeland. The mid-Atlantic, Baltimore, Maryland. Now I looked at her CV and I found out, well, how about that? She came in from gosh knows where and went to the University of Maryland, where she took all the prizes. And then she went on to medical school in Maryland, where she took all the prizes. At Georgetown, where she took all the prizes. And then she went on to further training at Johns Hopkins. And you won't be surprised to learn, she took all the prizes. But now I have to ask her, how did you make your way to the United States? Most Europeans go for fellowship. They go after they're incapable of learning the language.
Well, my father was a thoracic surgeon, and he trained at Georgetown, so I was exposed to American culture and the American universities from an early age. Okay. And when I was in high school, I took a trip and saw Georgetown and University of Maryland, and I said, oh, wow, this is where I want to study. So then I left when I was 17 years old. I left Greece and I went to America, and I stayed there for 15 years. So that's where I get the accent.
It's a lovely accent. It's so charming to hear a European who doesn't use British vowels. Well, that aside, so you decided to come back to Greece. You must have had any number of offers. Hey, stay with us. Stay with us. Come on. But you said no.
It was a very difficult decision. It was more of a decision of lifestyle. I sometimes regret leaving Johns Hopkins, which was actually one of the top hospitals in the United States, as you know. And it wasn't only the technology that was available, but it was my mentors. I was really devastated to leave those people in my department.
Kathy Schwartz and who else?
Kathy Schwartz was my mentor, and I owe everything I know to her. It was Maria Oliva Hemker, who's now chief of the department. Brilliant.
Okay.
It was Jose Saavedra at the time.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Carmen Gofari, who's still there. It was a great place to receive mentorship. And if I have to give an advice to our newer young colleagues, I would say, pick a mentor. It's so important to be exposed to people that can bring you onto new ideas, to make you think outside the box, give an example, be professionals in what they do, and really give you an inspiration. I was very lucky to be working and training at Johns Hopkins. I'm eternally grateful.
But
my professors.
You went back. You went back. Lifestyle. Greece was, well, aside from crab cakes, I don't think there's much that Baltimore offers that Greece does not.
Well, I made a mistake because I thought maybe going to Greece I would be working less. But actually, it was quite the opposite. I have to work, continue to work as hard as I did in the U.S. So That was a miscalculation.
Anyhow, you're back in Greece. You've made a wonderful career for yourself. You're contributing nationally and internationally. And I guess if you've listened to these podcasts before, then you know that at this point, we generally ask the person being interviewed for something that symbolizes their country to them, a song. Have you had a chance to think about what song might be yours?
Well, I'm going to stay away from Zorba the Greek, and I think I'm going to pick Chariots of Fire by Vangelis Papathanasiou, who is a great composer, and he composed the soundtrack of this amazing movie, an award-winning movie, as you can remember, back in the 80s, Chariots of Fire, on two British athletes that put aside prejudice and class distinctions and really won Olympic medals in the Olympic Games in 1924 in Paris. It was a very inspiring movie, and the soundtrack is so inspiring. And actually, it came up again in the press because the composer died a few weeks ago.
Oh, no.
And his songs were played here in Greece quite a bit in the last few weeks. So it's Chariots of Fire.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your insights into pediatric acute liver failure with us and with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex, very much. It was great chatting with you after all these years. It was a pleasure, and I had a great time. Thank you very much.